everybody today?
Great.
Good.
So you are those who did not go somewhere for South Bend spring break?
Yes.
So thank you for staying in town. We appreciate you guys being here. So welcome, everyone. My name is Amy Hotelling, and my husband, Mike, and I, Mike is the one that led the Kingdom Prayer this morning. We lead a home group here at Riverside, the North Shore Triangle Home Group. So if you're interested in a home group, you can talk to us. And today I'm going to share with us a story we find in Luke chapter 8 about a woman, a girl, and Jesus. So this story appears in all three Gospels. It is intertwined, which means like it's a story of two miracles that kind of goes back and forth between the two different stories in Luke's story and in all other three Gospels. And so because of that, these two women, this woman and this girl, they will always and forever be connected. So if you can stand with me, we are going to read Luke 8, 40 through 56 together, and you guys are going to have to read loud because I forgot to bring a Bible up here. So please read with me. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Okay, you can all be seated. So the story starts out with Luke telling us that Jesus is returning from the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Do you guys remember what he was doing on the other side of the Sea of Galilee? Anybody here last week? Okay. He healed a man who was possessed by hundreds and hundreds of demons. And then the people in that town told him to leave, so he heads back for the Jewish part of the Sea of Galilee. And there are crowds waiting there for him. Not really sure why they knew he was coming, but somehow they did. And there are crowds and crowds of people waiting for him. What were they waiting for? Can't be totally sure. I would guess probably most of them wanted to see another miracle. Maybe they wanted to hear some good teaching. We're not really sure. But we know what Jairus wanted. Now I'll tell you guys, I say Jairus. A lot of people say Jairus. I say Jairus because that's how Rich Mullins pronounces it in his song. So we're going to go with Jairus. So Jairus, the synagogue ruler, comes and he falls at Jesus' feet. And what he wants is he wants Jesus to heal his only daughter. She is his only child. She is 12 years old, and she is dying. Who was Jairus? We know that he was a synagogue ruler. And a lot of you guys might be thinking, oh, it's a rabbi. But it's actually not. A synagogue ruler was involved in arranging worship services, so kind of involved, you know, not being in the main sermon maybe, but pretty involved, and he was the part of some kind of ruling board of elders. So, you know, elder, ruling board, you know, modern example might be somebody who's a deacon or an elder, not the senior pastor, but they're kind of involved in the worship service, kind of like maybe Benji Wood. So Jairus kind of had that position. What do we know about Jairus' daughter? Well, we know that she was his only child. The text says his only daughter, but we know from the Greek that she was his only child. We know that her father and her mother loved her deeply. And I think, I don't know about you guys, but we have kind of a stereotype of Jewish society in that day and age not really valuing female children. But I think this story tells us that that's not exactly true. I think they really loved their daughters as well. Jairus' daughter was part of a respected family. Her father was a synagogue ruler, which meant he was pretty well known and pretty respected in their little town. So people knew them, people cared about them, people loved them. Luke tells us she was 12 years old. What do we know about girls who were 12 years old in that time in Israel and in the Roman Empire at large? We know that she was pretty close to the age that she'd be getting married, actually. I know we think that's pretty young, but in that day and age, Jairus and his wife were probably working on arranging a marriage for her. So she was close to becoming married, to becoming a woman. She was very close to, you know, probably having kids in the next couple of years. And she was about to die before her life of reproduction could even begin. And I think it's no coincidence that her story is so intertwined with this woman who is hemorrhaging, who had not been able to bear children for 12 years. So basically, from the point where this little girl was born to the day this story takes place, this woman has been bleeding. So their lives are very intertwined in this story. They're very different women, obviously. The woman with the hemorrhage had been, I mean, she's pretty isolated. She's been scarred by years of bad health and infertility. And this girl is young. She's loved, she's cherished, she's part of a family, a respected family, and unlike the woman, she's on the verge of becoming a woman. Jairus begs Jesus, please come and heal my daughter. She's dying. There is no time to lose. So obviously, they're in a big hurry. And if you can imagine, like your only child, a precious little girl, is about to die, you have got to be panicked and in a desperate hurry to get to your house so that Jesus can heal her before she passes away. But the text says that the crowds are crushing Jesus and crushing them, and they're so crowded that they can barely get through. The imagery that Luke uses in this is very similar to the imagery he uses in the story of the seeds that the farmer scatters. There were the seeds that fell in pretty good soil, but they grew up and they were choked out by thorns and weeds. That's the same verb and the same imagery that Luke uses here. So this place was packed. Have any of you guys ever been to a sporting event that was like super crowded? Maybe a rock concert, like you're just packed in with people. Has anybody been to New York City and ridden the subway? Anybody? Okay, a couple of people. So I lived in New York for about 3 years and took the subway to work and everywhere I went. And when I think of this story and how packed Jesus and the disciples were in this crowd, I think about getting onto a crowded subway car. It is like everybody is in your personal space. Like, you are up in their armpits. Like, it is, there's way, I mean, oh my gosh. If you're claustrophobic, like, good luck. There are way too many people in this car, and you have to push to get in and push to get out. And it's really, really crowded, and everybody's just pressed up around you. So Jesus and Jairus and the disciples are trying to push through the crowd. And they're in a big hurry because they're trying to get to Jairus' house before his daughter dies. And then all of a sudden, Jesus stops. And then he says something really illogical and really pretty crazy. And let me warn you, he's going to do this a couple more times in this story. Like, really crazy. Like, Jesus, are you off your rock or what are you talking about, crazy? He says, "Who touched me?" And he starts looking around, like, for real. And everyone near him, I think they're kind of afraid to, like, acknowledge the obvious, but they're all saying, "Not me, not me, I didn't touch you." And then Peter, you know, I think he feels a little more comfortable with Jesus, like, they're pretty close. So he feels like, you know, maybe I can state the obvious here. He says, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." So in other words, Jesus, everyone is touching you. Are you kidding? And I know what Peter and Jairus, I'm sure, have to be thinking is, what are you doing? We're in a hurry. This girl is about to die. But Jesus is adamant. Like, he's not going to let it go. And I think you probably know that Jesus isn't asking this question because he wants information. He could figure out who touched him and who was healed. Jesus is probably thinking, Peter, you doofus. I can tell there are tons of people touching me. Someone specific here needs to hear from me. So who touched Jesus? Well, this woman who, like the other female in the story, the little girl, is also desperately in need of Jesus' healing. So who was she? What can we know about her? Luke says that she's been bleeding for 12 years and no one could heal her. And I don't know about you, maybe this is because I'm a woman, maybe it's because, I don't know, but I would think that guys probably think this as well. When you hear woman and you hear bleeding and you don't hear about a specific injury, you think female problem, OBGYN, gynecology, reproductive issues. And I just apologize ahead of time for everybody who has kids here. This is going to be a sermon that they're going to hear some stuff they might not have before. So she's been bleeding for 12 years. And in Luke's time, you know, as well as today, this is universal. This goes beyond history, culture, geography. This is a condition true for women everywhere. All the scholars I read said this is a reproductive female problem. Nobody thought it was a nosebleed. Yeah. Luke, who we know from the book of Colossians, Paul tells us does anybody know his profession? What was Luke? He was a doctor, yeah. So he describes this, and he's a doctor, and he says, in his account, he says no one could heal her. And Luke goes off pretty easy on the doctors, I think. Mark, however, gives us a little more detail. Mark says, "She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse." And I think about this woman's situation and I think how hopeless. She had tried and tried every medical cure possible, and now not only was she out of money that she all spent on medical bills, her condition was even worse. She had tried everything. What can we know about her? One thing that struck me as I studied this passage was that she somehow had money of her own, which I tend to think is a little odd, but if you remember from earlier in Luke 8, that there were women following Jesus, and Luke tells us they were supporting him out of their own personal money. So we know that at that time, women somehow, they did have their own money sometimes. So this woman at some point, she had her own money. However much she had, it was all gone now, and she was financially ruined. She'd spent it all on medical bills. Another thing that possibly was going on was, with all this bleeding and no feminine hygiene products at the time, she probably smelled. So people probably didn't want to be around her for that reason. Susan Titus pointed that one out, so you can thank her for that. Unlike the little girl, who had her father to come and plead for her, evidently this woman had no male relatives that could come to Jesus and ask for help on her behalf. She evidently didn't have a husband. She didn't have a father who was alive and well enough to do this. She didn't have a son. She probably didn't have daughters either. She didn't have friends like the story of the paralytic when they cut the hole in the roof and they lowered him down, like his friends came, brought him to Jesus, helped him out. She didn't even have that. So she came by herself. We can probably assume she was not married, at least not at that time. She could have been divorced. She was pretty isolated, we can see from this, and she was financially ruined. So why was she unmarried and she had no children? It's pretty easy, logical assumption to think this had to do with her medical condition. She'd been hemorrhaging for 12 years now, and if you're doing that, you probably can't carry a pregnancy, so you can't have kids. Also, with this constant bleeding, men weren't gonna wanna marry her or stay married to her. What was her medical condition? We don't know. You can't know for sure. It could have been severe endometriosis. It could have been fibroid tumors. It could have been cancer. We don't really know, but we know that regardless, it rendered her infertile and undesirable. How many of you have heard sermons on this woman before? Probably most people here. I mean, if you've been in church more than like a couple years, I mean, it appears in three of the Gospels. It's very commonly preached on. And how many of you have these sermons have, a lot of the sermon has been based on the idea that this woman was socially ostracized because she was ceremonially unclean? Have you heard this before? Have you heard that her touching Jesus would make him unclean and she was afraid he'd be angry with her and all of that? So I've heard those sermons too, and I really liked them. Like, they have great conclusions. I really enjoyed them, and I thought their conclusions were great. But I did all this research, and I kept reading, and stuff just wasn't adding up. And the more I read and the more scholars I looked at, I realized that those things were possibly true, but probably not. At the very best, they're making some huge assumptions, and it's a big stretch. So I'm not going to bore you or gross you out any more with the details, but suffice to say, I have become the local expert on what Jewish women could and could not do while they were on their periods or having uterine bleeding. I know all about it. Thank you. We'll just sum it up with a quote from a biblical scholar. Her name is Amy Jill Levine, and she's not the only person I read that said this. But she writes, there is no unambiguous evidence from the Mishnah, Josephus, the Gospels, etc., that Jewish groups in Hellenistic and early Roman times removed the menstruant or one suffering from abnormal, I spared you some of the details, bleeding from social contact. So to translate this quote into stuff that like you and I can understand, there's no evidence from writings from Jesus or Luke's day. Like, nobody said anything that really clearly demonstrates that that culture was going to make women leave society, whether that be for a few days or a long time, or make them social outcasts because, you know, either for a week because they were on their period or for 12 years because they were hemorrhaging. There's just not much evidence. There's just not evidence for it. So that was something very interesting that I learned. What the scholars said who really looked closely at the Leviticus passage and the stuff in the Old Testament law about this, they looked at the context and they looked at it deeply and they looked at how it was currently applied in Jesus' time. What they said was, really the only time this mattered would be if you were gonna go to the temple. And where does this story take place? Galilee. Galilee is a long way away from the temple in Jerusalem. Jesus is not going to drop by there for evening prayers before he goes to bed that night. There was no chance that she was going to mess anything up for him. So if she wasn't ostracized or a social outcast because of being ceremonially unclean, and she wasn't afraid of Jesus getting angry at her, why didn't she just, you know, come and throw herself at Jesus' feet like Jairus did? I mean, she wasn't going to make him unclean. Well, I think there are a couple of really obvious reasons that are just, they're in the text of the story that make it really clear as to why she wouldn't want to do that. First of all, Jesus is in a big hurry. There's a little girl that's about to die, and he needs to get to her house. And this woman, I know she feels like she's way, way less important than Jairus and his beloved, precious daughter. We can tell that even though she's not a social outcast, she's definitely isolated. Like, she had nobody to come and help her out. So we know she's isolated, and isolation really breeds a sense of worthlessness in people. When you have no friends, you have no family, you have no one to help you out, you start to feel pretty worthless, and definitely more worthless than Jairus's precious daughter. She also has no money. Financial ruin can make you feel worthless. So she doesn't want to take Jesus's time. She just wants to secretly touch him. She wants to be healed and not be noticed. Just move on. Don't take his time. And she doesn't want to take away time from Jairus, who's trying to get to his daughter before she dies. There's also another really obvious reason as to why she doesn't, like Jairus, just fall at Jesus's feet and ask for healing. Let's picture this. First century Jewish society, very male-dominated patriarchal culture. You've got a single male rabbi, a co-ed crowd. Are you going to come up and be like, hey, Jesus, would you mind healing me? I've been on my period for 12 years. Like, who's going to do that? I mean, even today, just picture, let's say we have a healing night at Riverside Church. Come up, tell us in the microphone what you need healing for, and we're going to pray for you. Like, you just don't do it. Because you see, we all know this, but infertility, it's a problem that can be easily hidden. And it's pretty taboo, even today. And so people hide it. And you can't look at a man or a woman and see that they're infertile or that they're having female gynecological problems. It's different from the lepers and the blind people and the paralytic that Jesus healed. Like, you could see what their issue was. You could see what their medical problem was. There was no healing it. And when he healed them, everybody knew. But infertility is different. And yet, it's still devastating. Luke tells us, and all the gospel writers tell us, that this woman spent all her money trying to find a cure. And this is not too different from today, also. I have a friend who, in the past 2 to 3 years, I believe, has spent $50,000 trying to get pregnant. I have a friend from high school who, in the past 4 or 5 years, I think, has spent about $150,000 trying to get pregnant. I know people that have taken second mortgages on their house to try to finance their first adoption. And adoption can be just as expensive or more expensive than these fertility treatments. Mark says she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. And this is the same today as it was in the past. There are good doctors today, and there are some doctors out there that are not so great. And I have personally suffered under some of those doctors. Before I got married, we've been married for 2.5 years now, and before I got married, I thought I knew where babies came from. And then I got married and I realized I don't know where babies come from. I've been trying to make a baby for 2.5 years now and hadn't happened. And I also realized that my doctors don't know where babies come from. Like, even doctors who can make babies in a test tube, they don't know why it works sometimes and why it doesn't. Nobody knows where babies come from. So like the woman in this story, we have to don't want to talk about infertility. And I mean, especially, my gosh, to a single male rabbi in a patriarchal culture. He's not going to understand, she thinks. This issue is invisible, it's unmentioned, and those of us who suffer from it, we suffer not only under doctors, but like she was afraid that Jesus wouldn't understand and probably just didn't want to talk to him. We suffer under these things as well. Dealing with infertility or infant loss or miscarriage, when you're open about it, you can get a lot of bad advice and hurtful comments from well-meaning people who want to help or from people that don't know you're dealing with it. You can get advice like, well, you can just adopt. And that's pretty hurtful. Not to say that adoption isn't a beautiful, wonderful thing. I mean, it is. But when your easy answer is, you can just adopt, it communicates to the person hearing that adoption is easy. And adoption is not an easy process. It's long, it's expensive. Matches fall through at the last moment after you've already had a baby shower and the birth mom changes her mind. It's not easy. And also saying, oh, you can adopt? Not that it's not a good thing, but it communicates to you that you should have no pain over not being able to have your own biological child. That's a great pain. It hurts regardless. And so saying you can just adopt, it's going to cause your friend to suffer more. And one of my personal favorites, well, it's fun trying. Keep it G, because there are a lot of kids here. But we'll just say that when trying involves going to the doctor a whole lot, drawing blood, running tests, undergoing surgery, spending thousands and thousands of dollars, trying is no longer fun. Then there are the doctors who don't have a medical degree, but you know, they've gotten pregnant before, so they think they can tell you how you can get pregnant. And they want to give you advice on how to get pregnant. So if you are getting this advice from your friend who has been able to get pregnant and thinks your body must be just like hers, it's frustrating when you're spending thousands of dollars to a very smart, experienced, reproductive endocrinologist to try to help you have a baby, and your friends think they know more than that doctor. It communicates to you, if you're dealing with this, that you're not as smart as your friend, maybe you're not trying as hard, basically that it's your fault that you're not having a baby. So I know that people, when they say this, like, they mean well. They really do. We know that. All of us dealing with this know that. But it's just really hard to hear these things. Then there's the other side of the coin of infertility, miscarriage and infant loss. People, you know, when you meet somebody, often the first question they'll ask you is, do you have any kids? How many kids do you have? Now, well, me, like, I'm lucky. I've only been married 2 years, so I can say, no, we don't have any kids. We've just been married 2 years, and I kind of fake it through it and hope they don't, like, think we've been trying. That's what I do, but not everybody can do that. And even though these questions are really innocent, they can be really heartbreaking for somebody who's been trying for a long time or who has had miscarriages or stillbirths. So how many kids do you have? What do you answer? Do you give the answer of how many living kids do you have? Do you give the answer of how many living kids you've had and how many have died or been lost through miscarriage? It's a hard question to answer, and women really wrestle with that. I have a friend who lost twin girls at 22 weeks, and for her, this question is especially difficult. How many children do you have? Infertility and infant loss, as in the case of many women, are problems you just can't see at first glance. You just don't know. And a lot of us who suffer from them, we just leave these problems hidden, like this woman wanted to do with Jesus. So what do we do with her social ostracism or isolation? I mean, she was isolated. Maybe not because she was ceremonially unclean, but she was definitely isolated. So why was she isolated? I think she probably isolated herself and for a lot of the reasons that women dealing with this do today. So she goes to the town well to draw water with other women. What do the women talk about? They talk about the kids. They talk about their husbands. What's she going to talk about? What is she going to share with them? How is she going to feel? Every birth announcement she hears, every wedding that she hears about, it's all going to be pretty heartbreaking for her. So I think maybe she just pulled away. Statistics today show us that 1 in 8 married couples deal with infertility at some point. So that means that for those of you who are married or have been married, more than 10% of us have dealt with this. And I think the number, that's just infertility. I don't think that number includes miscarriage and infant loss, so the number is probably even higher than that. So that's not a small number of people in this room. Statistics show that the medical reasons behind this show us that about 1/3 of the infertility problems are due to women's issues, about 1/3 of the problems are due to male factor infertility, and about one-third are some combination of both. So you might have the stereotype that when women can't have babies, it's mainly because of women's health problems, but really it's probably about 50-50. Part of it's a man, part of it's a woman. However, it definitely hits women harder regardless of whose fault, quote unquote, it is. And I think also one thing the statistics don't reflect is that singles understand this as well. I wasn't married until I was 38 years old, and I always wanted kids, and I felt like I understood to a certain degree what infertile women were going through, even though I wasn't married yet. So because this is such a taboo issue people don't want to talk about, those who haven't struggled with it are pretty unaware of how painful it is just to be involved in normal community functions and how hard that is for people dealing with this problem. So just, you know, if you haven't dealt with this, just humor me and picture this for a moment. Think about trying to go to a baby shower after you've had a miscarriage. Think about how cutesy creative Facebook pregnancy announcement after cutesy creative Facebook announcement, how that feels if you've been trying to conceive for years or if you haven't been able to carry a child to term. It's pretty hard. Think about Infant Dedication Sunday. You sit there during the prayer with your spouse and you think, why are those couples up there and we're not? Jesus, why can they conceive and I can't? Why did their babies live to be dedicated and mine did not? Think about Mother's Day. Everybody passes out pink carnations, all the moms get a pretty flower, and you get passed over. And I know people don't mean to hurt us, they do so without knowing. But we don't realize how deeply embedded children and having children and birth is in the life of any community. It's just a part of the community functions. And how hard it is to be in community if you're dealing with infertility or infant loss. So a lot of times, in order to avoid the pain, people will just leave community and isolate themselves. So I think this woman's isolation was not very different from what we deal with today. Women do stop going to church while dealing with this. It happens all the time. Couples stop going to family reunions because they're tired of hearing about all their cousins who are having babies. Women will avoid friends with kids or who are pregnant. People just don't know the pain of pregnancy announcements, baby showers, the well-meaning advice that people give. And so women would just rather not talk about it than deal with the advice and the misunderstanding that being open about this brings. So they stay quiet and they stay away. So hear me now, I am not suggesting that we forego baby showers or birth announcements or infant dedication or Mother's Day or any of that. Like, I get it, like we have to do it. It'd be ridiculous to just stop those things. Like you have to move on with normal life. It's just, that's the way the world is. But what I am suggesting to everyone here is that you be sensitive before you speak. You can't see infertility, you can't see infant loss, so don't assume that the person you're talking to hasn't dealt with it. You don't know, unless you know them pretty intimately. So if you don't know, just try to think first about how your questions or your conversation might affect somebody in the off chance that this is what they're dealing with. Just be sensitive. That's all we can ask. Now, if you're here today and you are struggling with infertility or miscarriage or infant loss, there will be an announcement at the end of this service, but Ann Harbaugh and I are starting a support group for women who are dealing with these things. Contrary to what you might believe, we didn't time this to happen with this sermon. It was kind of funny. I hadn't seen Ann in a long time, so we were going to get together for lunch, and I didn't know it, but she wanted to get together to talk about starting this support group with me. And she didn't know I was preaching this sermon on Sunday or what the sermon was about. So we really believe that the timing for this has really been providential and that God is leading us to do this. So to be involved in the support group, you don't have to be from Riverside. If you have friends you know that are dealing with this, they don't go to church here, they're welcome. You don't have to be a Christian, they're still welcome. You do have to be a woman, and you have to have some pain around this issue. So if you're interested, talk to me or Ann. There'll be an announcement afterwards. There are flyers up front with information on how to get involved. So back to the woman. I think we've pretty well established why she would sneak up behind Jesus and try to do all this very quietly. So the woman touches Jesus, and to her horror and nightmare, somehow Jesus knows she's touched him. And somehow he's not going to let it go, despite the rush to save Jairus' daughter. And the woman knows this. And I figure she figures the kind of guy that knows somebody touched him for healing in a crowd like this, like if he knows that, he's going to be able to figure out who he is, or who she is, and who touched him. So she figures she might as well come clean. So she comes, falls at his feet, trembling in fear before him. And Luke makes sure that we know that she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed in the presence of all the people. So she told her taboo secret medical problem in front of everyone. Co-ed, male culture, men, women, she did it. This was in a society that it was rare for women to stand up and make public statements at all, much less to talk about healing of uterine bleeding. So she came forward and she talked. Why did Jesus pretty much make her do this? Why did he virtually force her to bear her deepest shame in front of everyone? These were questions that kind of haunted me. And I was talking to a friend about this, and she just said, well, how would we know that this even ever happened? It's not like a miracle of healing the blind or raising somebody from the dead. Infertility is invisible, so how would we know the story at all unless she talked about it? And I think Jesus having her speak and blessing her, I think he wants to show God's love and care for barren women. We read about that all through the Old Testament, Abraham, Rachel, Hannah, Sarah. And in the New Testament, we have John and Elizabeth. But what we don't see yet is Jesus as God caring for women who cannot have children. And I think Luke wants us to know that Jesus, as God, cares about this too. He cares about our pain and our isolation. He sees us. And she thought this rabbi, he could probably heal her, but I do not think she ever thought he would understand. But Jesus sees and he understands. And this reminds me of the story of Hagar. She was the woman that bore Abraham's first son, Ishmael. And when she was in the wilderness about to die, God rescued her. And after this happened, she said, "You are the God who sees me." And I think Luke wants us to know that Jesus is the God who sees us. He sees women. So Jesus seeks her out to tell her what God has done for her, so that she will tell everyone. He didn't let her remain isolated or hiding in the pain of her infertility. He makes her speak out. And I think we need to speak out today too. Maybe not as publicly as this woman did, but if you are dealing with some kind of secret pain, and that might be infertility, that might be something else, it could be medical, it could be something else, don't isolate yourself. Talk to Jesus about it. Trust him with it. And talk with other believers who can help you walk through it. Trust them with it. Don't isolate yourself. So how does Jesus respond to the woman's confession? He says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." It's a simple statement, but it says a lot. Daughter is not the first term I would use to describe this woman. It's kind of ironic that he says this. She's not young enough to be his daughter. She could have even been older than him. So it's kind of an odd name to give her. It's also the only time in the Gospels that Jesus ever calls anybody daughter. She's the only one. And he says it in all three accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So what is Jesus trying to tell her through that? I think he's trying to tell her and us, as we learned earlier, that Jesus has redefined family. He has called family those who hear God's word and do it. And she has, through her faith, been healed. She's heard God's word and she's done it. And now she's part of the family of God. So he calls her daughter. But what is the other female character in this story described as? What name is she always given? Jairus' daughter. So it again links this woman with Jairus' daughter, and it gives her equal status with Jairus' daughter. Jairus' daughter had a mother and a father in a community that loved and included her. This woman who had been bleeding, she did not. But Jesus calls her daughter also. He reminds us and the crowd and the woman that she is also a daughter. And then Luke records probably the most important message in this part of the story. Jesus says, "Your faith has healed you." And the word for healed in that sentence is also the same word as saved. So what Luke is trying to tell us is that faith in Jesus saves us spiritually, physically, socially. Jesus heals us. Faith in Jesus heals us. Meanwhile, Jairus wants Jesus, he's waiting through all this commotion, all this searching for this woman, this confession, all this stuff, and he's got to be dying inside. Like, he has no time for this. His daughter's about to die. And then right as he hears this woman confess her miraculous healing, before the words "go in peace" are even out of Jesus' mouth, a messenger from his house comes and tells him, "You didn't get there quickly enough. Your daughter is dead." And he's got, it had to have been a roller coaster experience. He's had to have been like amazed and hopeful that Jesus could heal this woman. And then at the same moment, he figures out it's too late. His daughter has died. And the messenger says, "Don't bother the teacher anymore." And I had to think, like, that must have been tempting for Jairus. I mean, he's got to be kind of frustrated with Jesus. He was just dilly-dallying around for a woman who didn't even want to talk to him. And in the meantime, his daughter died. And Jairus is already risking kind of a lot being associated with Jesus. If you remember, like, the story of Nicodemus, who was pretty high in the religious group, like, he came to Jesus at night, secretly. Jairus did this in the day. He's a synagogue ruler. The Pharisees have already condemned Jesus. It's not great for your religious reputation to be hanging out with Jesus. So he's already risked a lot, and now his daughter has died. He had to be asking himself, was it really worth it to bother Jesus anymore? But Jesus overhears the messenger and tells Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed." Don't be afraid. We've heard that phrase a lot from Luke. Just trust in Jesus. So Jairus decides to have faith. It's worth a shot. Let's go to the house. Let's see if Jesus can heal her. He does this in faith in Jesus, just like the woman who came and asked for healing from Jesus. They go to the house, and Jesus only brings three of his disciples and the parents of the little girl into the room that the girl is in. There are mourners at the house. They are weeping. They are wailing. Make no mistake, this little girl, she was dead. She was definitely dead. They already had the professional mourners in. She was gone. She was dead. And then Jesus does something else crazy that is kind of like the other crazy things he did in this story. He tells them all, "She's not dead. She's asleep." And everybody's like, "You're kidding. We know she's dead." And they laugh at him. And then Jesus kicks them all out. And goes into the room, he takes the little girl by her hand, and he says, "My child gets up. Her spirit returns to her, and she is resurrected from the dead. She walks around, she eats." And imagine that. Jairus and his wife were shocked. And then Jesus does something else that's kind of crazy. He tells Jairus and his wife, "Don't tell anybody about this. Don't talk about it." So for the woman that wanted to keep everything quiet and secret, he made her come out and talk. But for Jairus and his wife, who, frankly, this resurrection would be impossible to keep secret, he tells them not to talk about it. But there's no way people weren't going to find out. I mean, a bunch of people saw her dead, and then Jesus walks into a house, and then she comes out walking and talking. Like, what do you think happened? Jesus rose her from the dead. Scholars that I read, nobody seemed to have a real clear idea as to why Jesus didn't want Jairus and his wife to talk. A lot of people kind of guessed maybe that having these huge, large crowds were starting to be a problem for Jesus' ministry, and he didn't want to attract more people. But really, who knows? What we do know is that Luke told us these stories, one after another, to communicate to us that Jesus is God. Jesus has power over the storm, so that communicates he has power over nature. The next story, he heals the demoniac, shows that he has power over the spiritual realm. And then in this story, he heals the woman with the flow of blood. He has power over disease. And then last, he finishes it off by raising a girl from the dead. Jesus has power even over death. Who else has this kind of power but God himself? Luke is trying to demonstrate Jesus is God. And what do we learn also about God himself from the story through Jesus? We learn that God calls us to be daughters when we were not. We learn that he redefines what family is. We learn that in a male-dominated culture, Jesus showed radical love for women. He saw them. They were worth his time. They were worth his healing power. This sick woman who was isolated and alone, as much as this beloved girl who was the daughter of an important family. They were all daughters of the living God through faith in Jesus. So as we come to communion, I want you guys to remember this Jesus who died and was raised for us. He has power over nature, demons, sickness, even death. He was God in the flesh, and he cares about us, men and women, all women, young and old, beloved, even isolated. This God cares, and he sees our deepest pain and our deepest shame, and he wants us to trust him with that, and he wants us to trust our community with that and not to walk alone. Through his death and resurrection, healing faith in Jesus, like this woman had in the story, we're saved. So come to the table as you are ready.